This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from Tantalk Radio Network Studio, right here in the Tampa Bay area, because today we are talking to somebody who knows the Tampa Bay area so well. Hi, I have on the phone Jason Viewick. Jason, are you there?
Yes, I am. How are you?
Oh, Jason, it's so nice to talk to you because actually I wasn't going to talk to you, but I'm talking to you because my sister, Natalie, loved your book. And she often previews books for me. And first of all, she's laughing her head off when she's reading it. She loves sports. And so she just got into it, but it wasn't the sports so much. She loved everything you knew about Tampa Bay. And so she came to me, she said, you know, everybody in Tampa Bay has to read this book. And I said, well, I guess I have to read it. Because my interest in football goes as far as the guys wearing the tight pants. I mean, that was sort of my side of it. But it is a great book. It's a funny little book. And it's so much more than just being about football.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, I was a Bucs fan. You know, I grew up 100 miles south of Tampa in Punta Gorda. So Tampa, to me, was always the big city. You know, it was this big industrial city. It was kind of gritty in the 70s when we would drive through it going north, you know, before I-75. Went all the way from our town past Sarasota. You know, we'd go up Tamiami Trail, cross the old Sunshine Skyway. And, you know, I always wanted to write a book about the Bucs, my favorite team, but I also wanted to write a book about Florida history and about the Bay Area just so I could learn it myself.
Well, you did, and it's, as I said, it's so much more than a football book, because I was intrigued with all of the history that you put in. I didn't know, you know, I live here in near Clearwater, and I didn't know all of the history that's in this book, and I think it's just fantastic.
Well, you know, and I thought about, you know, when I chose the title, The Yucks, 2 years in Tampa with the losingest team in NFL history, I realized that some fans today might see that as some dig on the Buccaneers. But for those of us who lived in Tampa and in Florida and watched the Buccaneers in the beginning, and then after the Doug Williams years when they had that wonderful team with Leroy and Doug Williams and Jimmy Giles, then the Bucs lost 14 years in a row. And for us, it was almost a badge of honor that we supported this terrible team. And I'm not referring to the Bucs today, or, you know, the Super Bowl years were wonderful. And even now, we might be mediocre in building, but we're not the same franchise. And that's why I wanted to write it. You know, how people in the Bay Area all those years supported a team that truly was the worst team in football.
Well, I discovered so many things. First of all, I learned a lot about football, which is nice because I knew nothing about eye formations or any of that stuff. And so so it was an education for me because I, you know, not being familiar with it, then learning, of course, some of the names I knew mostly because if they were handsome, I probably knew who they were, but I didn't know too much about them. So you filled in a whole area. And I think the character that I found most intriguing and so fascinating, and I was so happy that I learned about him because he's just wonderful, wonderful and interesting, John McKay.
Oh, yes. John McKay, you know, Tampa has kind of softened on its views of John McKay over the years. He's kind of seen as this grandfatherly leader, you know, that won with the Bucs in the early days. But he had a rocky road. You know, he came to the Bucs, the new expansion team, in 1976, the first year. He had won 4 national championships at Southern Cal. I mean, he was one of the great college football coaches of all time. He was like Nick Saban or Urban Meyer. But he came to Tampa, and he just didn't have the talent. The league treated him poorly, just didn't give him good players to start. The NFL draft in 76 was weak, apart from Leroy and Dewey Selman. There really wasn't any other way to build a team. There was no free agency in those days. So you simply got what the league gave you, and you took your lumps for 4 and 5 and 6 years. That's just what you had to do. And that was hard on McKay. And so all of his quirks and all of his, you know, mannerisms, he liked to tell jokes, he liked to make people laugh, but he was also imperious, arrogant, acidic, and acerbic. He could be really nasty to people, and he would take it out on players. You know, not oftentimes not directly, but, you know, in jokes. And fans thought his humor was funny, but a lot of players told me, hey, you know, when McKay turns that laser beam of sarcasm on you, it's not so funny anymore. And so, you know, it was a fascinating, you know, study of a character. Because I think coaches, you know, we want to make them, like, into statues. They have all the qualities we want to exhibit and none of the bad things. But I think that's what makes him a great coach, that he is such a complicated and problematic and fascinating character. And that's why I think McKay lost so terribly in the beginning.
26 straight games.
I'm sorry?
Yeah, 26 straight games. I mean, yeah, that's losing.
Yeah. But then, you know, he said, I'm going to get to the playoffs within 5 years. And people in the Bay Area, you know, after losing 26 straight games, I mean, come on, I don't see it, right? We don't see this happening. And they really wanted him out. But then he gets Doug Williams. His plan starts to work. And by 1979, they have this magical run and almost make it to the Super Bowl. I mean, so McKay is one of the worst records all time for an NFL coach who coached, I don't know, 100 games or so. But he also was, before Carolina and Jacksonville, he was the coach to take a team to the playoffs in the earliest and shortest amount of time. So very impressive.
He was very impressive. The humor in this this section about him is I think that's where my sister started laughing her head off. And you know, what I also discovered is that, you know, for all of the sort of maybe roughness of his nature, he was a great guy, and was, I love that he when reporters were writing about a black quarterback, he said, no, you write about a quarterback, and not, you know, not to use color or try to, you know, separate.
Sure.
And
sure.
I thought that was just a great thing about him.
Well, I think, you know, people don't realize, you know, when the Bucs came in 1976, Tampa had a lot of racial problems. Tampa Bay, Hillsboro, Pasco, Florida in general. Doug Williams wrote in his book, you know, you can't go no farther south than Florida. And so when the Bucs came, they had a lot of problems. People sent, you know, a rotten watermelon in a box to Doug Williams. You know, really nasty stories. And John McKay was having none of that. You know, there's a famous tale of how he helped in an indirect way to integrate Alabama football. He brought USC into Alabama with one of his greatest teams ever, and they just murdered, you know, the Alabama Crimson Tide. And a lot of the boosters thought, well, we can't really have a segregated team anymore. And that was kind of supposedly a plan with Bear Bryant and John McKay, who were friends. So you know, McKay, he even went into the crowd, or tried to go into the crowd one time when people were yelling racial slurs at Ricky Bell. So I have to give McKay that. I mean, you know, he supported his players when he got his players, not his original players. He supported them unconditionally.
You know, one of the things I discovered, first of all, I didn't know there were so many people, so many players on a football team. I mean, there have to be so many back there. You see them on the field and you think, well, there's a few extras on the side. But there's so many of them to deal with. Wow.
It's amazing. And it's amazing what people don't realize is, you know, the turnover in the NFL, even today, is so great. I mean, you root for a team 1 year, 2 years later, it's almost not recognizable. You know, it's almost a different team. These guys are ground up and spit out so quickly. And McKay, in the beginning, looked at 140, I mean, the numbers always change, but upwards of 150 players cycled through the Bucs that first year. I mean, they were bringing guys in, taking a look, putting them on a plane, sending them home. They actually tried out a Coca-Cola delivery man.
Oh, I love that story, that they weren't trying out just the delivery man. They tried out lots of people. They brought them in and let them try out. And I didn't know they could do that.
Oh, yeah, as long as you meet a certain number on your roster by a certain date. And they were trying anything. Guys from the defunct World League of American Football. The Bucs had one guy who hadn't played in a year. They brought him in mid-season. He played in one game, had several tackles, was cut the next Tuesday, and never played in the NFL again. One game, his entire NFL career, mid-season, never came back.
But
and that was common.
But he must just glory in that one day.
I think we all would. Right?
You know, and I was, well, as I said, there were so many surprising things. First of all, I didn't know that the Rowdies were even existed in those days, and that one of the soccer players came to try to get on the football team.
Oh, Derek Smethurst. Yeah, he actually he punted and he kicked field goals and tried to make the team, but was playing for the Rowdies then, and the Rowdies were competing for a championship, and he probably would have been a very good punter. You know, he seemed to have a lot of skill, but it never worked out. Dave Green was the kicker, a really funny guy, came over from the Bengals, and when he told his mother that, you know, he'd been cut by the Bengals and he was signed by the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, she had never heard of the Buccaneers. This is 1976. And she goes, "What, you're kicking footballs at Busch Gardens?"
Well, you know, just everything. Of course, you talk a lot about the owner of the Bucs and how the franchise, you know, was bought and brought here. And that's a fascinating story in itself about the owner. The owner.
Oh, sure. Hugh Culverhouse was the owner, and he was a tax attorney from Jacksonville, who, unlike a lot of owners today, I mean, he wasn't born with a silver spoon in his mouth. He was a self-made man who, into his late 30s, was a civil service worker for the IRS. So he wasn't a rich man. He made money over about a 10-15-year period in private business as a tax attorney. He helped corporations relocate to Florida, wealthy people relocate to Florida where there was no income tax. And when he bought the Bucs, he had a lot of money, but it was all sunk in land deals. He was really leveraged. He wasn't liquid. And so when he purchased the Bucs, he actually had to borrow money simply to pay for his down payment. And so the Buccaneers' season tickets were often due several weeks before his payments were due. And so he was always squeezing the team from the very beginning to make money. Now, he made a lot of money, don't get me wrong, but he wasn't a Mark Cuban. You know, he wasn't a billionaire owner that didn't care about, you know, expenditures for, you know, video game consoles for players and plush towels. Hugh Culverhouse counted every dime. And so once he started to make money, by the 80s, this was a problem. He treated the team the same way while he was making more and more money. So the Bucs would often have the smallest front office, one of the smallest headquarters and training facilities, and one of the worst records and the lowest payrolls, but they would make as much money as any other team or more in the league. And so that was kind of the history of the early Bucs. Taught Culverhouse how to be a penny pincher in the league, and which he did for the rest of his career, the rest of his life, actually.
Well, you have lots of colorful stories in there about him and about his wife, and which I, again, it's why this book is so much fun is that there's enough for everybody in here, for really diehard fans who know all the names, and then enough of the background story, like how they decided on the name of the team. I mean, even that was a big process, and I had never thought about it. You know, how did you get the name? But
there were committees, several committees, the VIPs, local VIPs, Red McEwen, Tom McEwen, the writer's brother, an attorney, Leonard Levy, a local printer. And all these people came together to decide. They had to sit in a room. This is in 1975, downtown in an office building. What's the color going to be? What's our color scheme? And everyone had different ideas. But eventually they chose orange for Florida citrus. So that was the basic color. But then the second color they chose was aqua. And this was actually announced to the press. And a lot of people don't know this. The Buccaneers' first colors were orange, aqua, and white. And the NFL learned of the report that went national, and they called up and said, "Hey, you ever heard of the Miami Dolphins? You ever look at their uniforms?"
And they
weren't quite aqua, but close enough, orange, teal, and white. And so the Bucs quickly had to change course. They met again, this committee. And they chose several shades of orange and a red. And they actually brought a color palette, and they liked the shade of orange, a tangerine orange, that the Miami Floridians, a basketball team in the ABA, had. They used to play in Tampa on occasion, and they liked that color. So that's how they came up with the colors. And then the Buccaneers, the Tampa Bay idea, this inclusive idea, the Rowdies had already done that successfully. You know, they would play some games in St. Pete, they'd go to Sarasota, they'd go to Mall, they'd go to Tampa Stadium, and everybody liked that idea. So what could we do? And pretty much the most popular name in call-in shows, write-in shows, and just among the committee was Buccaneers for Gasparilla. That was the idea. Now, lastly, Bucko Bruce, they had submissions from Lamar Sparkman, the Tampa Tribune cartoonist. And according to Bill Markham, the first communications director, Sparkman's first drawing was a hangman's noose.
Okay, which, I don't think so.
Which would have been absolutely bizarre, right? On a football helmet. And luckily, Markham said, no, we need something that's not a pirate. We need someone who's swashbuckling, someone who's, you know, I describe him as a 1970s BG. And that's what they got, which was
he's Errol Flynn.
Errol Flynn. I mean, funny and ugly, and the colors were ugly, but in general, I loved all that. I love those old uniforms. I wish they'd wear them all the time now.
Well, I don't know why there was some controversy about the creamsicle color uniform, which I think was cute.
Yeah, I think too, though. If you look back, I remember in the 90s, I'm not sure that time, I think it was 96, 95, 96, 97, when they changed uniforms. I was happy, as most people in Tampa were. I mean, Bucko Bruce was such a drag on the franchise. You know, 14 losing seasons in a row, the worst winning percentage in the history of football, that we needed a change. And I personally like the new ones, and I like the whole breath of fresh air that came in. But now I feel this nostalgia. I think a lot of people in the Bay Area do. And every once in a while when they bring them back for a throwback day, people like it. You know, people really do like it.
Yeah, they do. And, of course, now we go back, and it's funny that a lot of people are watching on television all of the old Johnny Carson shows, which are hilarious. And we have to mention that the Buccaneers were a subject of many of his jokes.
Oh, absolutely. And that's why I write the book. You know, the Bucs lost 26 games in a row to start the franchise history. And this is a story in and of itself. But there are bad teams every year in every sport. But America doesn't come unhinged, you know, laughing at the 76ers in basketball or the Detroit Tigers 10 or so years ago.
They better not.
Something has to happen. Exactly.
They better not laugh at the Tigers. I'm from Detroit.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Well, you know, something, you know, in the culture of the 70s, you know, maybe post-Watergate, maybe, you know, the oil crises, the inflation, you know, maybe it was just America needed to release and laugh at someone or something. But the Bucks became really lovable losers, like the 62 Mets. I mean, Johnny Carson, a lot. I mean, every few nights would tell Buccaneers jokes. And in those days, he had 6-7 million viewers a night. And the next day, at the water coolers all over America, people would go, hey, did you hear the joke about the Buccaneers? And the Buccaneers became really famous. Tampa Bay became famous, not just for being in the NFL, but for being the worst team in America's most popular sport. And I discussed that, too, how the Bay Area reacted to being ridiculed. You know, people feared, in a way, that if Pittsburgh was the city of champions, what would Tampa be? Would Tampa somehow become, you know, Loserville or the city of losers? And it worked out that it wasn't. People embraced the team, even though they lost. Attendance went up, and when the Bucs finally won, it was national news. It went all over.
Now, which was it? A player or was it a coach who was paid by being given some real estate here in Florida?
Oh, that was Hugh Culverhouse when they brought in Doug Williams. The Bucs had lost 26 in a row. They finished the second year 2-12. They were 2-26, and they desperately needed a quarterback. And they drafted a relatively unknown star from a historically black college, Doug Williams. And he came in and immediately took control of the offense, took control of the team. He won, you know, four games in 78, had a broken jaw, I believe, came back the next year and led them to 10 wins and was the undisputed leader of the Buccaneers. And he became essentially, you know, I describe him as the Johnny Unitas of the Bucks. I mean, the Bucks had never won, and he wins 34, 35 games, takes them one game from the Super Bowl, and finds out he's the 42nd highest paid quarterback in the league, and they're only 2018. Hugh Culverhouse was paying him so poorly that he wanted more money. And, you know, there's lots of different stories. It's hard to figure out what's what, but they were several hundred thousand dollars apart in 1982, 83. And Culverhouse would offer things like, well, you know, I'm not going to give you this whole amount, but I'll give you part of a land deal.
Whoa.
Yeah, that kind of stuff.
Well, I think that...
And, yeah.
Yeah, if somebody got a land deal, $250,000 worth of land in the early 80s, they should be happy today because, that is worth a lot of money.
I mean, who knows? It might have been a piece of one of his orange groves in North Florida. I don't know. But he did own a great deal of the Lakewood Ranch area.
Oh, well, you know.
Sarasota.
Sarasota, my gosh, that's a booming place. So that'd be nice to get paid in land in Florida. I just want to thank you so much.
Sure.
You know, for coming on the program today. I was going to say, what's a Fulbright scholar like you doing writing about football? But you do it beautifully, and you're such a good writer.
Thank you.
And as I said, when you can make my sister laugh out loud, I know you're a great writer because I think I'm telling all, everybody who likes football should buy this book, and everybody in the Tampa Bay area who's interested in the history should buy this book. But I think it's a perfect book for young women to buy and, sit around Panera's reading this book, because you're sure to grab a guy who will come up and, you can start talking, and it gives you so much to talk about. I think this is you have to go on all those blogs for young women and promote this book, because it is, because it's always, there's so much in this book that you can talk about. I think it's a perfect book for young women. So that's what I'm going to do.
Well, that's the first time I've heard that.
That's a new marketing approach. Really, get out there, start going around Panera's and giving out books and saying, this is a book that everybody should read and every young woman should read in Panera's. Grab
it. Yes. Okay. I'll take that into account.
Okay. Well.
Hey, Jason, excuse me, second Patsy. Jason, I was just wondering that you're so detailed in your book, and I'm going to read it. I was just wondering, as a fan, did you save a lot of the games?
I'm sorry, did I save a lot of the games?
Yeah, did you like, record and save them, or?
Yes, I watched what I could, right. But I did find, there's a website by a man from England, of all places, it's called buckpower.com, and the guy has this copious website. I'm going to give him a shout-out because it was so pivotal for my book. He has the original game logs that the NFL, the sheets, like the score sheets, are signed by a score, and I was able to really follow every single down. And I couldn't watch every single game. I wish I had, but I did get to see quite a lot, and I did follow every single down on paper.
Okay, what is the name of that again, so people?
It's buckpower.com, and it's unbelievable for any fan. I mean, it really talks about every single game in the history of the franchise, every single player, every single game.
Wow.
I have DVD going back to 79. Of games.
Oh my God.
Of games.
Wonderful.
Yeah. I have the actual championship game against the Rams. And then pretty much from the mid 80s on, I taped every game.
Well, I have to say one thing about that championship game, that the Bucks lost 9-0 and didn't play very well. They were playing in Tampa. Mm. And the crowd, as the Bucks lost and the Rams took a knee at the center of the field, the Bucks, the stands, they were saying Tampa Bay back and forth, celebrating Tampa Bay. As they lost that last game, and that just really, it made me feel good reading about this poor team that had lost in their highest moment at the time.
Well, I think it's a wonderful book. I'm holding it up for the people who are watching on podcast. It's called The Yucks, 2 years in Tampa with the losingest team in history, in NFL history, by Jason Viewick. And the cover, I love the cover. And as I said, it's a wonderful book, and it's the kind of cover that if a girl is holding in Panera's, the guys will notice you and start talking to you. That's for sure.
Jason, did you have to get any permission from the NFL for this?
No. I mean, these are, you know, printed sources.
Good.
You know, I didn't have to ask any permission simply because, you know, it's my right to write what I want. You know, and I would have liked more help from the team, but they did help me in the beginning saying you can interview whoever you want. You know, I mean, they did help me in terms of giving me permission, but I interviewed former players that can do what they wanted to do. So there's not really any connections today with the Bucks front office and that original team. People are gone 40 years ago. You know, people have retired. I want to say one thing. I'm going to be at the Tampa Bay Times Festival of the Book in November.
Okay, I am too. Yeah. So I'll see you there.
Yes, wonderful. Well, thank you so much.
Okay. It was so nice to talk to you.
Take care.
Okay, bye-bye. You too. Thanks, Jason. Bye now. Good. Okay, we're going to take a little break, and I'll be right back with my guest in the studio.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
Looking for a good book? Then get over to Miami Avenue Book Nook in Indian Rocks Beach. Check out the latest books from local authors like Angela Hunt, who wrote the book for the film Risen, or Bonsu Brenvick, whose books preserve the memories of the Bellevue Biltmore Hotel. What do you enjoy reading? A thriller? A romance? How about a mystery or a sci-fi? At the Book Nook, you'll find it all. Remember, one of the joys of life is to read. Located in Indian Rocks Beach, look for the blue building with the mermaid on the side. On the corner of Miami Avenue and 2nd Street, two blocks south of the post office. Open Tuesday through Friday, 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. and Saturday, noon to 4. And don't forget, while you're there, check out Miami Avenue's great collection of Florida wines, local art, and fantastic gifts. Miami Avenue Book Nook, where you will be inspired to read.
Hi, I'm John Rakowski with Charles Ruttenberg Realty. Don't you love living here in the Tampa Bay area? Oh, I'm sorry, you don't live here yet? Well, if you already are or thinking about it, call me at my office at 727-538-9200 extension 2 for any real estate needs, including a free market analysis of your home. Your home is worth more than you can imagine. Call me today at 727-538-9200 extension 2. I'm John Rakowski.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
With a Z, and I'm back with a guest in the studio, Daniel Noy. Hi, Daniel.
Hi.
Okay, well, I'm so happy to have you on, and we're going to be talking about your fantastic sci-fi book, The Spider, The Witch, and The Spaceship, which is, I know, available on Amazon.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's talk about, well, first of all, a little bit about yourself. I know that you've been interested in sci-fi and writing for a long time. Tell us right. about yourself.
Well, let's. I guess it started in elementary school. I had a project. I was supposed to write a short story in fifth grade, and it just kept rambling and rambling, and I never finished it. But it gave me all these ideas, and I started thinking, wouldn't it be nice to make an action movie? And then it was in sixth grade. I met my friend Ryan at the bus stop. And we were just playing out scenes at the bus stop out of Star Trek: The Next Generation, which I watched religiously back then, and but eventually we just started making our own ideas and started thinking, well, this should be a television show. But then by the time he moved away, when I entered high school, I was already starting to think, even at that time, I actually really liked the writing, because something about bringing out the movement of three-dimensional objects in text, that was just, I like that. It's like an art form.
So it fascinated you seeing the written word.
Yeah.
And And the idea for this book, now I really enjoy this. It's, as I said, it's called The Spider, The Witch, and The Spaceship. And tell us a little bit about the character. The main character, name is Nathaniel.
Yeah.
And
it's Nate when he's an adult.
Nate when he's an adult.
Yeah.
And it's, it's a look into your mind. I you know, it's fascinating where you got all of the ideas, because it is another reality, another world. And so what do you want to tell about the book? What do you want people to know?
Well, it's about this guy named Nate, who he finds himself living in this psychological healthcare facility, and he doesn't know how he got there. He starts to have these childhood memories of like this really fantastical stuff. Like he remembers being a dinosaur, and he remembers flying around in spaceships and living stuffed animals called Grooshlings. So he's told that he has he's told that he has something wrong with his brain, so that he can't remember real things, but it becomes fantasized versions of those things, but he starts to wonder. There's little clues that maybe the memories are actually real, but what he's been doing is shifting from one parallel universe to another.
Ah,
so there's kind of a mystery through the whole thing.
And it is, because he could be exactly doing that, because he goes from different place to different place, including I like particularly the planet Candy.
Yes.
That's a fun place to stop off.
Definitely a good place to visit if you're ever in the area.
Exactly. I think there's some of your love for some of the foods there, like chocolate and. What can you tell us about Planet Candy?
Well, it's made out of candy, for the people and the plants and the animals are all candy. It's bioengineered, although I don't get into those details in there. It's just kind of mentioned that everything's got a very high sugar content, and yet somehow it's alive. Again, I don't really get into the biology.
Yeah,
much
well, you don't have to, because it's a kind of planet that everybody wants to visit. I think it's you don't gain any weight. You can just munch away on everything that you find there, right?
I guess so. Especially now if you're young Nathaniel, he's a dromaeosaur, which is same family as that's the family velociraptors are a part of. High metabolism, like birds.
And so he can just eat his way through the entire planet. And you know what I like, you use a word in your book. You use a nice word. You say dizzyish, and dizzyish looks really nice. I hadn't ever seen anyone write dizzy with a ish at the end, and dizzyish is exactly. It's a great description for your book, because you go from place to place, and it is sort of a dizzying kind of experience of what's happening really to Nate, Nathaniel, or as you say, a dromaeosaur, who has the green feathers, right?
Yeah.
So that's interesting. And then what he sees in all of these different places that he goes, and you have a very vivid and very extravagant imagination.
Yeah, I was trying to capture the elements of childhood, at least what I remember from it, and definitely dizzyish is a word I would have made up if I had the chance. Well, I did eventually when I was older, but
yeah,
in the book. Yeah. But you know, it's basically they don't know the whole language; they just make up. Well, that works, you know.
Yeah.
If you get dizzy, you're dizzyish.
I think it's a word that should just go straight to the dictionary, because
it should.
I mean, it's so descriptive, and I think we've all, if we're lucky enough to have these the ability to imagine something fantastic and otherworldly, and imagine going from place to place, it is a dizzyish kind of feeling, and I think it's a great word. So what do you want to talk a little bit, how the spider, the witch, the spaceship, all sort of where those ideas come from?
Well, that was actually an interesting story in and of itself, because see, my since sixth grade, I've been having loads of ideas for just an ongoing series of Nate and his friend Derek, and it was there's just hundreds and hundreds of ideas. I'm like, I can't turn these all into novels in a lifetime, and I couldn't even finish the first one. I had a hard time for a while trying to finish anything, and so finally I decided, well, I just have to start the series somewhere, and I decide, well, let's start at the beginning, and that's where I started doing the flashbacks first, based on Nate's early life as Nathaniel. And then I started thinking, well, it's not that interesting by itself. What if it was a frame start? These are actually flashbacks, and then there are clues about how the universe changed, how he became human, and all this other stuff. And why my working title was In the Beginning. And then my father says, you know what, that's a terrible title. Why don't you call it something like The Spider, the Witch, and the Spaceship? You know, sounds like the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe kind of thing. It's catchy. And I was like, yeah, that's a good title, but yes, there's a spaceship in it, but there's no witch, and there's no spider. Oh, yeah, well, there is a small part that there's a spider, and suddenly it hit me. And I knew what the last chapter would be and how it would tie all three together. The witch is revealed in the last chapter. The spaceship is revealed, who the spaceship is. And the spider starts out with a very small part, ends up playing a major role in the last chapter, and it kind of ties it all together.
And that came from your father's suggestion?
Yeah, just from the title. He can't come up with the title, and then I came up with why the title was appropriate.
Well, it is actually a perfect title, and your father is so clever, and I'm sure he will want royalties for this, because...
No.
Well, I don't know about that, but I think it is a very clever title. And as you said, I was so intrigued with the idea, and I as I'm reading, I'm also wondering, you know, where is the title coming in? And I was so happy with, well, I love all parts of the book, but I thought when you got to the ending of the book, whoa, that really grabbed me. I really enjoyed all of, how you wrapped it all up. I thought that was fantastic.
Yeah. It either will explain everything, or you'll just be left more confused than ever. It's one or the other.
Well, exactly. So, but it doesn't matter, because by that point you've really enjoyed yourself through the whole book. So, and it's as I said, you because of the way you look at things, and you're looking through, you know, Nathaniel's eyes as a child at why there's a lot in there about learning why you do things or why you. Sort of behavioral things like good manners and all of this that you bring in. It's funny how you explain, you know, why there are rules, I guess we could say it.
That's basically what I remember from childhood. I exaggerated a little bit to make a point.
Yeah.
But, you know,
but that's what you're supposed to do in a really fun book. So, but tell us a little bit where you get that idea about explaining why we do or how kids are given rules, I guess.
Oh, I don't. Well, I mean, just in general, it seems like adults in general, not just my parents, but like teachers and in general, it's they expect you to already know what they want. They don't explain themselves. It's just like, you know, you're punished now. and you know, teachers are the same way. And I think sometimes you should try to explain things first, and I even see this when I'm out in public. I'll be sitting at McDonald's, and the next table kid does something, and oh, I gotta go closer.
Yeah, a little closer.
I don't know. Kid walks under a table, and the parent just like gets after her, says, yeah, "Don't do that." Why? Never explains it. You know, just don't do it because I said so.
And so Nathaniel learns a lot through all of this, and one of the sort of ongoing characters is the mommy and daddy in various forms.
Yeah.
So, but it's I think it's a great you know, a great little book, and I think that you know, for everyone out there, there's so much that sci-fi offers you when you're looking for something to read. I hadn't been a great sci-fi fan until a number of years back. I started reading it, and I realized that it does, first of all, it opens your mind to a lot of different ideas, because in, you know, if you read books about everyday things, you're sort of thinking about everyday things. But sci-fi opens your mind up, and you start thinking, well, why do these things exist? Exactly like Nate writes about, why do you do this? Why do you do that? Why do you do that? And seeing things in a different perspective. And so I've become a great fan of sci-fi. And are you working on another book now?
Yeah, I definitely eventually want to get back to more traditional novels like I did already. But right at the moment, I got to get this other project out of the way. I'm working on at least a 4-year project. It's going to be a trilogy with what I call micro chapters. Like each book would have 212 micro chapters. They'd be between 1 and 5 pages long. And just because I have so many ideas of Nate's life, maybe a bit avant-garde for some people, you know, been like summary form like that. It's almost a short story or flash fiction, but just to get all that out, and then I can move on to the traditional stuff. I got all kinds of ideas for that. I'm working on a bunch of stuff simultaneously, actually.
Well, you're a fine writer. I went to your website, which is very, very nice, and we will talk about it because it's a great little site, and it's called theinkdoodler.com.
Yeah. Well, there's no the, and it just inkdoodler.com.
Inkdoodler.com. Yeah. And inkdoodler.com, you have a lot of your artwork, which I think is also very fine. You're a good, very good artist. And it's available for purchase, so anybody who wants to go to inkdoodler.com, you can buy some of Daniel's work, and I think it's really interesting. I would I'm going to buy something just to hang up on my wall because I really enjoy it. Well, I love dinosaurs too, and I can see where Dan's been involved.
I've got a dragon.
And a dragon. Yeah, I saw that. And it's very, very nice work. And I wanted to just mention to Dan and to all of you who are interested in sci-fi that last Thursday I had Mike Resnick on, and I'm holding up his book. He was on last Thursday, and I just want to tell you, over the weekend he won several more awards, and I just can't keep up with him. I think he's won now maybe 200, 300 awards for science fiction. And the wonderful thing about Mike is that he is a great believer in helping young writers. And so he started a anthology series, a magazine called Galaxy's Edge, and it's online. You can get it at just galaxiesedge.com. And it's a wonderful source for anybody who's interested in sci-fi. First of all of the fiction is fantastic. I mean, it's just very, very well written. You can get a subscription to the. Sort of a large size anthology magazine. You can get a subscription for $14.95. And so anybody who's doing any work in sci-fi should be really reading these authors that are in these anthologies. What Mike does is he always has 4 to 6 famous science fiction writers, and then he has 4 to 6 not famous, unknown writers. And he likes to start people's careers. So if you have a short story, I suggest that you submit it to Galaxy's Edge. The contact information is there on the website. And I'm hoping that, Daniel, when you have something available, that you'll submit something. Because I know that just the minute I started reading your story, I was thinking to myself, whoa, Mike Resnick would like this. And that's a big compliment. Because if he likes something, you'll find out that when somebody's won 200 awards in science fiction, he knows what he's talking about. So
I should hope so.
So I think that, it's wonderful that you've done this work. And I'm looking forward. As you said, it's going to be a couple of years. But as you do it in sort of a layers, you do a little bit here at a time. When you have something ready to send in to Galaxy's Edge, I think it would be a wonderful opportunity for you to get something published.
Yeah, well, the micro chapters, any one of them could be turned into a novel, could be turned into a short story. I've actually had some people tell me that they actually would like to read something like I've described, where it's like 212 microchapters, it's 1 to 5 pages each. Just Nate's life just goes on and on and on and on. He's got all this stuff.
Well, no, it's. I think there is that there is a market for, first of all, because so many people are reading things.
And they have shorter attention spans.
Exactly,
yeah.
The short attention span. People read it now on their phones or on the iPads. And so they have only a limited time that they can read. So short is good nowadays. People are reading short. And there was a time where I think people had sort of gone off short stories altogether. But they're coming back in a big way. And so it's a wonderful opportunity for writers to get out there and get known and then just to build their career from there. So I think that, you know, you are well on your way, I think, with this book, and I hope that people will get it. It's called The Spider, The Witch, and The Spaceship, and it is available on Amazon.
Yeah.
Okay.
And find out more at inkdoodler.com, as more information about it, too.
Yes, and also, as I said, you have quite a few stories there, blog type of thing.
I've mostly doodles, but whatever random thought pops into my head ends up on there. So I mean, there's a whole lot of stuff.
Yes. Yeah, so it's a site worth visiting, and I think that
poetry too. I got some of that.
Oh yes, I forgot to mention that. So it's a wonderful site, and I think that all of my listeners, and I know I have so many who are now working on science fiction projects, and to read Daniel, I think, is a inspiration, and I really enjoy learning more about Nate, and I'm looking forward to reading 212, did you say?
Yeah, 212 microchapters per book. So
212.
Six, yeah, 636 why? For the whole trilogy.
636. Okay, why did you pick 212?
Because
is that a nice number for you?
Okay, well, this is...
Yeah, I need to know why. Otherwise, I'm going to be... for a week, I'm going to be...
Believe it or not, there's somewhat of a reason.
I needed to know because I was thinking to myself, if I don't ask him why 212, then for weeks, I'm going to be saying, why 212? What's the significance of that?
Well, it was... there was... Oh, am I still not?
Well, we have to talk into the mic. Daniel likes to swing around these rolling chairs a little bit.
You're lucky I'm not up and pacing.
So, tell us the truth.
What happened was I had an idea several years ago for one of the adventures of Nate would be he would discover something called the weirdness quotient, which, just make it really simple, is when you start time traveling, every time you land in the past, even if you're not overtly changing anything, just your very presence there sends really small changes that ripple through and end up when you're later, you land somewhere in the future, it now things are slightly different. And it starts affecting your life, where you land and stuff like that. So it becomes more and more exciting. And so time travelers, they find their lives gradually over sometimes hundreds of years, if they live long enough, get more and more and more weird in the sense that they are put in places of importance. You know, they're not just landing in one village and they're saving one village. They end up somewhere where their actions could affect the fate of the structure of reality itself sometimes. So Nate finds himself in these more and more, and he looks back over his life and sees that, hey, my life's been getting, I've been getting more and more and more important here. And also some of the things, it's not just creatures. It's like really hard to describe stuff like temporal paradoxes and things. And so he figures out that this weirdness quotient is in effect, and he has a choice to make. He realizes one of two things is going to happen. Either his life is going to get weirder and weirder and weirder until the structure of reality itself breaks down and nothing makes sense anymore, which would be terrible. Or if he flips a switch, his life will peak and it'll start gradually getting more and more boring, which is also terrible. So, I won't get into the conclusion of that, how he actually solves the problem, but I started making this trilogy plan where one book is weirder than the next, and there's certain episodes needed to be, and there's other reasons too, but it would take forever to explain. But they, I needed different episodes in different books. And when I started counting up the number that would be in the middle book, I realized it was, I think, about 209 when I first counted it. And I wanted to, you know, give myself a little bit of a buffer. And I looked at, well, basically, so I decided they, I wanted them about the same length. And I didn't like the number 209. And I just,
212 is great.
Yeah, I just picked 212. I actually, at first, was thinking, well, nice round number like 222, but then that would end up being 666, and someone would think that meant something when it doesn't.
Yeah.
So
212 is perfect, and I look forward to having you back on the program when you have 212. But right now, I just want to thank you for joining me today. It's been fun to talk to you, and it's Daniel Noy.
Yes.
And Ink Doodle.
Ink Doodler.
InkDoodler.com.
Yeah.
And have a look at his website. And just before I leave, I want to just remind everyone about Sebastian Roberts. It is his birthday tomorrow. And I had him on the program a few weeks ago. I love his book, The Dragonfly, which is a political book, the perfect book to get for this time period. And it's lots of fun, a great read. And so I would like everyone to go to Amazon and buy one of Sebastian Roberts' books. There, he has quite a few books, and they're all really lots of fun. And as a special gift to Sebastian, do a review. Do an Amazon review. And this is the nicest thing that you can do for any writer that you know. Write a review on Amazon, and it helps them a lot. And I just want to wish Sebastian a very, very happy birthday. And I know that he'll be back on the program when he has his next book coming out. And again, and the same thing for Daniel Noy. Get his book and do a review on Amazon, because it helps. And every writer, independent writer, needs at least 50 reviews. And I know that so many of you read the books and then you sort of forget to write the review. But take a few minutes of time. It's a wonderful thing to do for somebody, and it means a lot to every writer to get a nice review on Amazon, and it helps their numbers. So I hope you'll do that. And now on Thursday, I have Irene Goodman, and I am so excited to have her back on. Of course, she's one of the top literary agents in New York City. You can't get higher than Irene, and I hope that you'll be coming, you know, to the program on Thursday at 11 o'clock and listening to Irene. And I'm always thrilled to have her back on my program. Meanwhile, just find your joy and share it, and have a wonderful few days. And tonight's karaoke night at the Indian Miami Avenue wine bar, and that's in Indian Rocks Beach. So have fun, and go out there and sing and enjoy yourself. Bye-bye.